This is an oral history interview with Carl Storm on the 22nd of August, 2002, in Kingston, Rhode Island. Arthur Demerich and Arnold Thackeray are asking the questions. Carl, why don't we start with a bit of your personal biography, perhaps parents, family, background, where you grew up?
Okay. Well, I was born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland. Both my parents were raised on farms in rural areas, my father on a farm in rural Virginia, and my mother on a farm west of Baltimore. My father moved to Baltimore while he was in high school, graduated from Baltimore City College, which was a high school in Baltimore, went to work for a bank, got a law degree at night school while working for the bank, and eventually founded and ran the trust department for the Union Trust Company in Maryland. So he was from a very modest background, but he was successful in the Baltimore banking industry. My brother and myself were the first two in the family to go to university education, and we both had our undergraduate education at Johns Hopkins, and I stayed on and did my master's and PhD degrees as well. The family was quite enthusiastic about our getting a higher education, but after my staying on for a PhD, then 3 years of postdoc, they eventually became quite concerned as to whether there ever would be a real end to this. After Hopkins, I went to Stanford postdoc for a year with Henry Talvey, and then went to the NIH and spent a couple of years as a staff fellow in the Laboratory of Neurochemistry at the NIH.
Right.
And the idea was to go into the general area of the function of metal ions in biological systems. And inorganic biochemistry was kind of in the process of being invented during that period of time. People like Bert Valley at Harvard and Harry Gray was just going into it at about that same time.
Mm-hmm.
After a couple of years at the NIH, then I moved over to Howard University in Washington, D.C. in the chemistry department. Stayed there for 17 years with sabbaticals and side trips to Oxford, University of Trondheim in Norway, and Los Alamos. And then in 1985, I moved to Los Alamos on their technical staff.
Perhaps we could go back a little bit. When did you first develop an interest in chemistry? And was this as an undergrad? And
actually, when I was in sixth grade of elementary school, I decided I wanted to be a chemist. And I never really wavered from that. And my ambition was always to be a research chemist for DuPont. So I never quite realized that direct a connection.
Was that a chemistry set? Was it DuPont radio program?
Well, I certainly had a chemistry set. I had the classic Gilbert, was it? And it upset my family no end with the smells and the and the things that I used to make in the basement of that. I did a book report when I was in the sixth grade on a, it was kind of a fantasy thing, a trip to the sun. And it was, you know, imagining how you, and it was very successful. And my sixth grade elementary school teacher then had me go around the whole damn school giving this book report to, this verbal book report to all these different classes. I guess that was quite impressive. Then in the eighth grade, I had a very good general science teacher, and that was very encouraging. And then in high school, I had a very good chemistry teacher. He was actually a PhD chemist, and he was stuck in Baltimore for a couple of years because of some family situation. And he was also very encouraging. I think that all reinforced the idea. It was the family opinion that you really had to do something practical. So So when I went to Hopkins, it was as a mechanical engineering major. And I stayed there a year and a half, and then I spent 3 years in the regular Army. When I got out of the service in Superior Fort Devens, Massachusetts, I went to work for Foster Grant in Leominster and worked in their pilot plant and research lab for about 8 or 9 months, and then went back to Hopkins. And by that time, I had decided that, you know, whether chemistry was practical or not, that was certainly what I was interested in. And then during the additional 3 years to complete my undergraduate school, I became convinced going to graduate school was a good idea. So I just stayed there and did my graduate education as well. So it's a bit of an evolutionary thing.
Yes. Was there a problem financing this?
Not really. That was a time when the financing by the government was just really beginning to come on stream. And when I first went to Hopkins, I'm pretty certain the semester's tuition was $150. And although that was more money than it is now, it really was not, you know, it's nothing like $35,000. I was married after I got out of the service. My wife was a nurse. So, you know, between what I could do working part-time, I used to work as a mechanic some, and my parents were helpful, and what she earned as a nurse, undergraduate school was all right. And then at that time, you could get support from the NIH by writing a research proposal. And it's very much like an R01 grant is today for the NIH. So I wrote a research proposal on the coordination chemistry of metalloporphyrins, and it was funded for 3 years. So
this was funding your graduate study?
Yeah. Yeah. And then I wrote another one to postdoc at Stanford, and that was funded, and we had $2,700 for a year.
For the undergrad, for the one that funded your graduate study,
right?
Who were you working with? What inspired you? I mean, did you simply finish undergrad and say, I'm going to write a research proposal?
Well, I was working with Alsip Corwin on metalloporphyrins. I had done undergraduate research. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I would give a very strong endorsement to about my education at Hopkins was... if you got A's in your lecture and laboratory freshman chemistry, then second semester you didn't have to take the lab, you could do research with a faculty member. And the same thing for organic chemistry. So I was doing research with graduate students and postdocs the second semester of my freshman year. I was a little more mature than many because I had been in the service for 3 years. But to me, it was a very excellent experience. So by the time I graduated, I had had 3 years of practical research experience with several different people in the chemistry department.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you've tarried just long enough along the way to really catch the post-Sputnik tide.
Exactly, exactly. And I still kind of like that idea of a graduate student going to a place like the NIH on their own, because, you know, then I was working for this person. I had my own money.
Right.
And I was clearly not part of some big machine that was, you know, you're going to put one more functional group on this side of the molecule as your contribution to it.
So for there's a whole period there in which you're becoming and you are the classic academic research chemist, how it went.
Yeah. And, you know, when I look back on those times, you know, you used to make your own equipment. You know, I learned how to blow glass. I used to make my own vacuum systems. And, you know, you did things with your hands. I'm not sure that's true anymore in research labs.
Mm-hmm. What made you kind of think of moving away from Howard and so on? How did that That work, that looks like a significant career shift going to Los Alamos. Is that what it was?
Well, it was pretty dramatic career shift, if you will. I went to Howard in 1968, mm-hmm. and it certainly had a heavy element of the 1960s idealism in it. In fact, Will Lepkowski did a CNE News article on myself and several other people about that time. And the idea of combining a research career with teaching, and particularly teaching in a school that had a heavy minority enrollment, you know, I found very exciting. And Howard was just coming off of the 1955 court decisions, you know, requiring integrations of schools and whatnot. And it had actually quite a good chemistry department. It was probably easily as good as any other one in the Washington area, University of Maryland, Georgetown, GW. And I had this vision of being able to run a good research group and mm-hmm. teach and do socially useful things all at once. It turned out to be a hell of a lot of work, because the university really was not designed to support research. Mm. So you had to go out and raise 100% of money that you spent. You know, the idea of having a startup package, bizarre. Startup package maybe meant you got new blinds in your office or something like that. And the attitude of the research community at large was not necessarily hospitable. Many people in the larger research community are very protective of their turf, and they don't particularly want to see new units established that are going to be competing for the same money. Mm-hmm. And I sent an application into the National Science Foundation earlier on for an NMR spectrometer, and it came back with the referee's reports that the research proposal was excellent, the work was very good, but Howard University has no business owning a sophisticated piece of equipment like this. You know, it'll last for a year and then it'll be pushed over in a corner, and you know, because they can't afford to maintain it. And it's, you know, it was true in a sense that, you know, this was not a university that had, you know, a lot of resources, that if I got it, then I would be obligated to continue to raise money for it. But I think a lot of that was driven just by not wanting to expand the... another consistent response would be that when I approached mainline research sources, they would come back and say, well, this person is probably the best scientist on the Howard faculty, and all of these organizations have money to support research at minority schools. If they're going to spend it on anybody, they should probably give it to him. You go then to, say, the NIH MARC program or MBRS and whatnot, they all come with language that says, the purpose of this money is to transition research scientists at minority schools into mainline funding. So since you obviously have already been successful in that, you know, why don't you go for an R01 grant at the NIH, you know, and I would lay the two reviews down next to each other. Then in the early 80s, when Reagan got elected, and along with Mr. Stockman and other people, they just went through the U.S. budget and, you know, just hacked huge amounts of money out. And I just could not see the possibility of continuing to finance. I had about 15 people that I worked with at Howard in the Washington area, $250,000 to $300,000 a year in research money that I was raising all outside of the school. And I just could not see that continuing. Los Alamos offered me a job that roughly doubled my compensation. And so I moved from inorganic biochemistry to conventional high explosives at Los Alamos.
How'd you make that? Where did that contact come from?
Well, I did a sabbatical out there in 81-82 with the Stable Isotope Research Resource, which was an NIH DOE funded project to use carbon-13 and other stable isotopes, nitrogen-15, in biological research, principally by way of NMR. So I was there for a year with that. I always did a lot of heterocyclic chemistry, and because of other things in our research group, I knew how to put nitro groups on heterocyclic compounds. I began consulting with the explosives people about their synthetic projects, and they needed a physical organic chemist, NMR spectroscopist, to work in that. So they made me an offer I could hardly refuse.
You were getting interesting angles of vision on the research community.
Yes.
In this, at Los Alamos, as a program manager, well, you're chief scientist. How does this work? Your change of titles and roles at Los Alamos.
Well, I got out to Los Alamos, and that is an extraordinarily isolated place. And there are people that have literally been there since the Manhattan Project. And they found out, I guess largely because of my years of teaching and whatnot, that they could give me a set of view graphs I had never seen before on any one of a wide variety of topics. And 20 minutes later, I could make a presentation to a visiting group from DOE Washington or something and sound almost like I knew what I was talking about. So that was the end of my research career at Los Alamos. And you almost don't have the option of refusing, you know, those types of offers. In a big organization like that, if you want to prosper at all, you have to be a team player, and you have to do what that organization values. And so I moved into program management. I was shortly spending a week a month in Washington in places like Forest Hall, a building in Germantown, and attempting to explain and interpret to people in the DOE what basic research was and why investing money and looking at how high explosives function were going to lead to safety issues and performance issues that were of fundamental interest to the nuclear weapons program and to the Department of Defense and private industry as well.
Was there quite a cadre of chemists in Los Alamos? I mean, I think physics and I think Los
Alamos. Well, actually, engineers are the largest single professional group by far. Then physicists are quite a large group. Chemists are then behind them in terms of number, and spread across all the way from nuclear chemistry to synthetic organic chemistry to biochemistry to structural chemistry, and so it's a significant.
So what sort of number of chemists would there be?
There are about 12,000 people that work at the lab. I think about 2,500 or so of those probably are professional people, so there might be 200 PhD-level chemists.
So this really is different from Howard.
Oh my word, yes. And when I got out there, they had an old JEOL 90 megahertz machine that just dead on its feet. I said, well, why don't you buy a new one? And, you know, people I worked with said, well, it just can't be done. You just cannot imagine the bureaucracy that you have to go through. So I went up and talked to our division office. It turned out I needed to write a one-page memo, which I wrote. And about 2 months later, the deputy division leader himself comes down to my lab and apologizes that they can't fund it this year. But if I send it back in next year, he's absolutely certain it'll be at the top of the list. They then said, well, you can't buy it because the bureaucracy's too. So I went down to the purchasing agents, which, you know, it's a huge department, sat down with one of them, said, I want to buy something. What do I have to do? She gave me this long list of things that you had to do, and if you answer all these questions. I got done talking with her. She said, you know, nobody's ever done this before. I followed her directions. I bought it. It was delivered to the lab. But the people, I mean, out there are just so isolated, you know, from, and it's a culture hangover from, you know, going back to the 40s. And they don't speak to each other. They don't deal with each other. Mm-hmm. So I was, after about 3 years as a program manager, I was dealing with about $15 million a year in pretty basic and applied chemistry and physics. You know, that was related to the weapons program, shock physics, spectroscopy, synthetic chemistry, and whatnot. And that was largely based on, again, being able to talk to people and get along with them and go around and interpret, you know, both what they were doing to the laboratory management and what the laboratory management wanted to them. And I actually fired 4 or 5 people that have been supported for years out of this money because they weren't doing anything. That created a huge plan. It never been done before.
So you could do that within the federal system?
Well, I mean, I didn't not just stop supporting them. I didn't fire them literally from the lab, but I just stopped supporting them, you know, out of the money would come into a division, they would use it as a slush fund, redirect it to other things. And after a year or so, so I got better things to do, you know, with the money, and they would then actually winding up with the title of chief scientist was a bit of a quirk. The lab had set up a very sophisticated testing program to evaluate things that the Department of Defense did. And the theory was that they were going to be an honest referee. And they had, you know, superb computational facilities, and X-ray could take pictures of shape charges going through metal and everything. And they would look at everything that the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, other DOD labs did, and do the computations and make on come up with the best answer. Well, everybody hated it. You know, I mean, it just, and so after about 5 years, it got shut down. And the fellow that was running it at Los Alamos had actually brought a guy from the Army's laboratory in Aberdeen to run it. So they needed some place for him to go. So they said, Carl, we're going to give him, you know, this $15 million worth of money that you've been managing, and he will now be the program director for that, and you will go do something else. Well, my division leader wasn't happy with that, but again, you know, in an organization like that, you really can't argue about it. So he made me chief scientist for the division, which was a much better title. And frankly, I had no responsibilities at all. So, and 2 years later, that guy's money was down to less than $5 million. Because he really was not a very good manager, and they just put it other ways.
What does a chief scientist with no responsibilities do with his time?
Well, it was very short time after that that I took this job.
Okay.
It made it very easy.
What do you need to do to stop your 15 million shrinking to 5?
What I have needed to do?
Yeah.
Well, this was happening to the other guy.
Yeah, no, I understand, yeah. But it didn't happen on your watch. So what was the difference in...
Well, his idea of management was 100% top-down. He had projects that he wanted done, whereas my idea of management was much more like this organization functions, which is much more from a bottoms-up type of thing. And again, Los Alamos had a wealth of brilliant people. And when you sit down and talk with somebody and they say that, you know, they can outline this particular area of research that is has a very long-term implications for the nuclear weapons program, and they can do it very well, my attitude is you should support it. And I also wrote a strategic plan for energetic materials R&D, which they had never had before. And we could work off of that. And take, but the guy who picked it up had come from Aberdeen, and he had some very fixed ideas about what was good to do. And he would tell people, well, you're going to go now and work on this.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go talk to some other research manager. You know, why don't you hijack that money and bring it back over here, and then we'll continue to do this other project.
So, looking back, Carl, what did you learn at Los Alamos?
One of the things they asked me when they interviewed me for this job is, have you ever dealt with prima donnas? And I said, well, I was a program manager at Los Alamos. And they said, enough said. Well, I mean, there's certainly a difference between big science and little science, if you will. And I'm certainly firmly convinced that individual investigator-initiated research is a very important wellspring of the development of new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Once an area has been reasonably well defined and you have a good idea where you want to go, and the Manhattan Project was an excellent example of that. I mean, the physics of making a fission weapon was pretty well understood by 1940, and it was to a large extent an engineering problem. And a place like Los Alamos is fantastic for that.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to create new areas and new knowledge, to work through that kind of bureaucracy is not very kind to that type of individual innovation.
Mm-hmm. So you really decided you wanted to get out of Los Alamos. That was part of what was happening.
Well, the Cold War was over, and it was really not at all clear what was going to happen to the national labs, to the whole, I knew enough about the Gordon conferences that I certainly, the idea of working for them, I found very, very attractive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's,